Acts 16, last week we ended with Paul venturing out on his second missionary journey, and before he left, there was a conflict between Paul and Barnabas, and it was a significant enough conflict that they went their separate ways. They didn't go together on this journey. And what was the conflict over? John Mark, and what about him was the conflict? Barnabas wanted to bring him with him. Paul did not, because Mark had left them earlier. On the first missionary journey, he had gone with them to the work, and Paul didn't want him going back and abandoning him the second time. And so it seems almost as if they split up the work, you know, and returning and visiting the churches, because Barnabas and Mark went down to Cyprus, which if you remember the first missionary journey, Paul and Barnabas went first to Cyprus, ministered there, and then they went up into Pamphylia and Galatia, and then went back and went around over back to Antioch. So Paul takes the overland route, goes up from Antioch through Cilicia, and that's really where we start in Acts 16. Acts 16 is, at least portions of it are well known. What do you know, without looking at it, what do you know or remember about Acts 16? Yeah, the Philippian jailer. And so we have in Acts 16, Paul's journey to Philippi, which is well in the middle of the chapter, but that's what this chapter is probably most familiar for, is his imprisonment in Philippi and the conversion of the Philippian jailer. But before that, verse 1 of Acts 16, then he came to Derbe and Lystra. What was significant about Lystra on the first missionary journey? Yeah, that's where Paul was stoned. Paul and Barnabas had healed the man, and they began by praising them as gods, and then they ended up turning on them, stoning Paul. They went from Lystra to Derbe, then went back to Lystra and back around. And so there are churches in Derbe and Lystra. So the first part of his second missionary journey is revisiting some of these churches, and it's been a few years since they were there. And so the church has had an opportunity to grow, to mature somewhat. And we're told, verse 1 still, behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. And so we see that Timothy was not just at Lystra, but he was also ministering just north of Lystra in Iconium. So Paul wanted to have him go with him. Verse 3. And I'm going to stop right there for a second. So we know this name Timothy quite well. What do we know about Timothy? Yeah, he was, I would say, Paul's protege. So yeah, what else? He was a very faithful servant. His father was Greek. He is obviously the recipient of what two letters of the Bible? First and Second Timothy. He also is likely to have been one of the recipients of a third letter of the Bible. Does anybody know in what city Timothy was pastoring when 1 and 2 Timothy were written? It is the city of Ephesus. So it's possible that Timothy may have been at Ephesus when the Ephesian letter was written. It may not have been, you know, depending on several factors. But the Ephesian letter certainly was written to a church where we know Timothy later ministered. More importantly, we see, especially from 2 Timothy, Timothy was a beloved son of the faith of Paul. And he was one that, of all the individuals that Paul had traveled with him, Timothy seems to be the one that Paul held closest to him. And he was faithful despite some physical infirmities, despite some apparent personal tendencies. It seems like he may have been a little bit more of a timid fella, and yet he remained faithful, did the work of the ministry. We know he was younger, and so that when Paul takes him with him here, Timothy is a very young man. I think there's every reason to think that he was no older than his early 20s. He is a very young man at this point, but he already has a good testimony. And so verse 3, Paul wanted to have him go on with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was Greek. Because Timothy is raised in this Greek household, Even though his mother is Jewish, and she has certainly taught him scriptures, and Timothy's grandmother taught him scriptures. We know that from 2 Timothy chapter 2. We know that he was taught scriptures, and yet his father would have ruled the house. His father did rule the house. And so Timothy was not circumcised as a baby according to Jewish practices. And so now, as Paul prepares to take him with him on this missionary journey, Timothy was circumcised. Why? Verse 3 tells us specifically, why was he circumcised? Because of the Jews who were in that region. They all knew that his father was Greek. And so if Timothy, trying to minister to these Jews as an uncircumcised Greek, they wouldn't have listened to him. They would have treated him as an outsider. Now, this raises an interesting question here. Because if you remember the book of Galatians, there were Jews that came along and insisted that Titus be circumcised. And Paul absolutely refused. Titus is another traveling companion with Paul, ministering alongside Paul. And yet, in that case, Paul says, absolutely not. Here, Paul seems to initiate it and says, Timothy, you need to be circumcised. So why did he say absolutely not in regards to Titus, but yes in regards to Timothy? And I will say it has nothing to do with the two individuals at all. It could have been anybody. It didn't have to be these two men. Paul has Timothy circumcised for the sake of the gospel, that there not be an unnecessary hindrance to the preaching of the gospel. So why does he refuse to have Titus circumcised? What's going on in the letter to the Galatians? What's the big issue that Paul is writing about? It's the same as the issue in Acts 15. The Judaizing. And what's happened in Galatians is that they're insisting that Titus be circumcised to be a Christian. There's a Judaizing element to this requirement for Titus to be circumcised. And so Paul, for the sake of the gospel, refuses to have Titus circumcised because that would have distorted the gospel message. It would have given the wrong idea about the gospel, as if it was necessary to keep the law of Moses to truly be Christian. Now, Paul is dealing with an area where there are many Jews, and he's also going to be moving into an area where they've not ministered before. And so, for the sake of gospel opportunities, that there not be unnecessary hindrances to the gospel, Timothy is circumcised. So in both cases, it's a very definite gospel orientation. And I draw that out for us for a little bit, because as we think about our interaction with people for the gospel, how do we respond to cultural issues in light of the gospel? And so you probably have heard people at different times say, we become all things to all people that they might win some. It's exactly what Paul said in 2 Corinthians. And that's applied a variety of ways. I heard it years and years ago now, but applied as, that's why we're bringing in the latest cool music. We're going to be all things to all people so we can win some. And, you know, part of our thinking through this helps us actually answer, is that actually valid? Is it good to bring in the rock band and have the light show and the fog and all of that, have this huge rock concert before the sermon so that we might win some? And we can. I'm getting way off track here, but I think this is worthwhile. But we can't just stop and say, well, rock music is evil, therefore we shouldn't use it in church. There's an argument that if you're going to say that, you got to prove that. But as we're talking about this from a gospel perspective, we're asking the question, legitimately asking the question, is it appropriate to use whatever the latest cultural phenomenon is, cultural fad, if you will, in the church for the sake of bringing some to the church? And the question is, the question we have to answer is, what does the use of that imply about the gospel? That's the question Paul is concerned with Titus and Timothy both. And he's refusing to have Titus circumcised because to do so would be to misrepresent the gospel. The issue here, even as we're looking at ministry, And whether it be church ministry or personal gospel witness, is what does this method imply about the gospel? And so before I talk about rock music on the platform, let me switch a little bit. I have seen the gospel tracks that look like $100 bill. At least one edge of it looks like $100 bill. And it's actually designed to be left with the tip at a restaurant, so that the waitress, you know, sees the money, sees this $100 sticking out there. And of course, that's going to grab her attention, right? And yet, I think there's a real problem, a major problem with using that, because of what it implies about the gospel. What's the problem with using a fake $100 bill like that? What would you see as the problem? Okay, it could be attempting to communicate you believe in Jesus, you'll be getting rich. There's a bait and switch method, which implies something about the gospel. It implies that it's okay to be a little bit deceitful with it, even if it's well-meaning. And it's been abused. I've seen some situations where they don't leave any tip, just that. And that's just dead wrong. But not even addressing that extreme, even if you give a generous tip and include that, there's still that bait and switch, this deception to catch your attention so that hopefully you'll read and believe. And we talk about Jesus, John 14:6, he says he is three things. He's speaking to Thomas, he says, I am the way. What's the second one? The truth. Does it matter if we communicate the gospel in a way that it may be just slightly deceptive? Yes, because it touches directly on the character of Christ. And if I will use slightly deceptive means to bring somebody to believe the gospel, and I'm going to say this is true, this God of this gospel is true in him is no lie. But it's okay. I lied a little bit to get you here. The deceitful means is often counterproductive. And so go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And this is where Paul is talking about is the question of eating meat that's been offered to idols. This is a major issue. He spends three chapters on this issue in 1 Corinthians. It is a big deal. And what Paul ultimately concludes with the Corinthians is have nothing to do with idolatry. Instead, he says, whether therefore you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. That verse is a great verse. But it is directly in the context of, do we eat meat that has been offered to idols? And so Paul now goes on. In chapter 9, Paul speaks about his self-denial. So he says, am I not an apostle? Verse 1, am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? He is laying out his credentials and is saying, look, I am an apostle. I'm not under bondage to the law. I have seen Jesus. These are rhetorical questions. I have seen Jesus. You are the fruit of my work. So he says, if I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship. My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we have no right to eat and drink? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles? The brothers of the Lord and of Cephas, or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working? Whoever goes to war at his own expense, who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit, or who tends a flock and does not drink the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out a grain. Is it oxen God is concerned about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of this hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? If others are partakers of this right over you, are we not even more? Stop there. The whole point that he's making up to this point is, I haven't taken a salary from you. That's what he's saying. We know Paul was a tent maker. In various cities he worked. In fact, he tells the Thessalonians, I labored night and day among you, working among you, not just working to preach the gospel, but working with his own hands to supply their own needs, lest they take anything from the church that they're ministering to at that time. He's telling the Corinthians essentially the same thing. I took no salary. But now he presses the point and says, and I had every right to take a salary. I had every right to receive physical goods. And he points to the passage there, do not muzzle the ox that treads out the grain. God has prescribed in the Old Testament this principle that Jesus says the laborer is worthy of his hire. He's pointing to that saying we had every right to take a salary, but we didn't. Verse 12, right in the middle there. Nevertheless, we have not used this right, but endure all things. Why? Lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. This is the same principle that worked with Titus and Timothy. Paul is saying, I did not take a salary in Corinth, lest it hinder the gospel. If you're wondering why, the quick short answer is that at that point in time, there were traveling, I'll call them motivational speakers, traveling wise men who went around to different cities. They gave these various speeches and they were paid for it. Just like really famous motivational speakers, they get brought in to do this series of conferences or whatever they call them, and they get paid a lot of money. And there was actually the legitimacy of the philosophers' claims were measured in part by how much money he was making. So if you were in high demand and getting a big salary, then obviously your truth must be more true than their truth. And so Paul, for the sake of the gospel, lest it be understood in the same terms as these traveling wise men, he took no salary. And actually, 2 Corinthians tells us it had the effect that other, they called themselves super apostles, or Paul kind of mockingly calls them super apostles. These other ones came in later and said, he didn't even charge you for it. His truth must not be true at all. And yet Paul is divorcing the gospel in his ministry completely from these traveling philosophers. He wants no suggestion that his message and their message is in any way alike. For the gospel's sake, he takes no salary from the church in Corinth, even though he had every legitimate right to do so. Verse 14, he says, even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. But I have used none of those things, nor have I written these things, that it should be done so to me. So he's saying, now, I'm not even talking about this as a kind of a sideways way of saying you need to send me money. For it would be better for me to die than that anyone should make my boasting void. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. Verse 19, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. So Paul is telling the Corinthians, do not eat meat offered to idols. Do not participate in idolatry in any way. And one of the examples he gives of living like that is himself. He's already said, I didn't read it, at the end of chapter 8, he says, I will eat no meat. If meat causes my brothers to offend, I will eat no meat while the world stands. That's how far he's willing to go with self-denial. And he says here, see, I have done this. I take no salary, even though I had every right to do so. And I did this for the sake of the gospel. To the Jews, I became like a Jew. He is telling them, when he was among Jews, he ate kosher. He observed laws of clean and unclean. When he was not among the Jews, when he was among the Gentiles, those who are not under the law, he was not fastidious about it. And so when he went to one of these little island communities and they handed him a lobster, he didn't tell them, oh, no, I'm Jewish, I can't eat that. And so he says to those who are weak, I became as weak. I have become all things to all men. We read this in the context of 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and it is a context of self-denial. It's not a context of embracing all of my liberty. It's a context of denying liberty for the sake of the gospel. So that as Romans 14 talks about it, there's somebody there whose conscience is weak, who is offended by something that you have liberty to do. do not do it for their sake. And what Paul rebuked Peter about was when they were in Antioch in Syria, they were eating with the Gentiles. And then there were those that traveled up from Jerusalem. What did Peter do when those from Jerusalem arrived in Antioch of Syria? He stopped eating with the Gentiles. Him and actually Barnabas too. Paul tells in Galatians that even Barnabas was carried away with this. That they stopped eating with the Gentiles. And again, there's a gospel issue here. Because by doing that, Peter is implying the Gentiles were not all the way in yet. In religious terms, in terms of Christianity, these Jewish believers are more right, are better than these Gentile believers. And it goes back to the gospel issues. What's going on in the decision? What is the results of this? So Peter eating freely with the Gentiles until Jews show up, and then he stops. So it is different than what Paul's doing here, saying among the Jews I become as a Jew, among the Gentiles I become as a Gentile, because he's actually restraining his liberty for the sake of the Jews, that he might not offend them. He's not telling the Gentiles at all, you have to do the same things here that the Jews are doing. He's not suggesting that at all. And we do realize this is a little short statement of a pattern of ministry that by this point in time has been going on for years. There's a lot of details not included. So what did this look like when he was in a community where there were both Jews and Gentiles? It was many of them. What did this look like? And at that point in time, if Paul goes into a Jewish home, he's going to eat kosher. And he's not going to complain at all. He's certainly not going to bring his ham sandwich in his back pocket with him. He is going to limit his liberty for their sake. And when he does not have to, he won't. But again, his bent, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he says, if meat causes my brother to offend, I will eat no meat. He is much more on the side of, I'm just not going to eat what I have the liberty to eat. So I think in those situations where there is a mix, Paul is not going to separate from the Gentiles, say, I cannot eat with you. But he is not going to eat the shrimp that the Gentiles have brought because of the Jews. And in fact, he's even going to tell the Gentiles, the Romans tells us, he tells the Gentiles, don't bring shrimp to the church potluck. If you want to eat it at home, that's fine. But don't bring it to the church potluck because of the Jewish believers who are there who are offended by this, who would be not offended and their feelings are hurt and now they're mad and their kind of nose is bent out of joint over it, but that they might be tempted to sin by eating that which they cannot eat with a clear conscience. And that's the issue in Romans 14, and all of it goes to self-denial. So, question of rock music on the platform, and its connection to the gospel. I could talk about interpretive dance, if that would be better. It really doesn't matter. We have a wide range of issues here that we could talk about. So as I've been talking, maybe you've been mulling this over in the back of your mind there. Let's just say a full-on heavy metal band. We'll take the extreme to make it easier. A full-on heavy metal band up on the platform, the bass guitar, the guy with the long hair, tattoos, the drummer in a cage, the whole nine yards. What does that say about the gospel? Or does it say anything at all about the gospel? Part of what's going on is entertainment. Is the gospel about amusement? No. Does the gospel promise a life of ease and comfort? Think through Jesus' calls to discipleship. What did he require you to do to be his disciple? Take up your cross, follow him, die to self. We're not saying that entertainment in itself is evil. Now we're saying, is entertainment, that which is distinctly entertainment-oriented, we're talking very narrowly what it says about the gospel. Part of what it communicates, and personally I think there are many churches that I would now call entertainment-centered, where you come in and you have a really cool local band that they do a mini concert every Sunday for 30 minutes, and then some guy gets up and talks. And sometimes he talks for 20 minutes. But there is absolutely in the practice is an emphasis on the entertainment aspect, the experience, be another way of saying it, so that in those situations, the quality of the service is measured by the emotional response to it. Is the gospel measured by our emotional responses? Let me ask it a different way. Is believing an emotional or an intellectual response? And I know that's not a clear cut and dry. I'm going to say there is aspects of both, but the content of the gospel is factual. And so that the response is a response to information. I believe Jesus is God. That's a fact. And my response to it is that I accept that fact as true. What if I don't really feel good about that fact? Yeah, it's still a fact. It's still true. And so I believe, the gospel says Jesus died for my sins. Again, that's a historical fact. And there are theological facts embedded in that statement. And there are certainly aspects of that many people are not really comfortable with. I don't really feel good about somebody else dying for what I've done. But can I believe it without necessarily feeling great about that fact? Yeah, my emotional response can maybe be a little bit more on the negative side. At least, I think as we're saved and we grow in our salvation, we come to rejoice in that fact. But even there, I think there may be still times in our lives where we think, really? He died for my sin? I don't really feel good about that. Facts do not care about your feelings. There are facts that have to believe. As far as I know, there is no feeling you have to feel to be saved. Now, yes, there are feelings that accompany salvation. There's a feeling of conviction, if you want to call that a feeling. But there are facts that have to be believed. And if we are communicating the gospel entirely in terms of emotion and minimizing fact, then we are misrepresenting the gospel. If we are communicating the gospel purely in terms of entertainment, of what captivates our attention because of the show, then we're misrepresenting the gospel. And so as we think about that specific question, rock heavy metal band on the platform. The question is, what does it say about the gospel? And I do argue that it misrepresents the truths, key truths of the gospel, about the God of the gospel and about the right response to the gospel. And there are other issues that are out of the scope of the conversation. All of this stems from this model of Paul that we see not just modeled for us in Acts, but taught to us in 1 Corinthians. That when we are examining our gospel witness, we're examining our interaction with unbelievers, we have to consider how our methodology, how our lives reflect on that gospel. What does our method say about the gospel I'm preaching? And if the method is not in line with the message, we need to alter the method.